Hello, and welcome back to Slut PhD. I am your host, Julie Fennell, and in this episode, I will be reading the first chapter from my book, Please Scream Quietly, A Story of Kink. I've had a number of people lament to me that my nonfiction books are not available as audiobooks, and I am seriously considering trying to read them out loud myself because as yet my publisher has not approved them for audiobooks, and I might do that. But at present, I'm going to stick with the information that's publicly available, which is to say the samples that you can get off of Amazon for my books. I'm going to start with the excerpt from Please Scream Quietly, which was published in 2022 by Littleman and Rofield and is sole authored. And of course, there will be a link to it in the episode notes. Introduction. Your fantasy is my reality, not your standard deviant. The summer of 2012 was brutally hot at Camp O-Town, where I conducted much of my fieldwork and many of my interviews studying the pansexual, BDSM, bondage and discipline, dominance and submission, sadism and masochism, subculture. And the 100-plus degree heat, it didn't seem particularly strange to sit in the shade, naked and dripping with sweat, with a recorder on a table between me and my interviewee, having a long conversation about how they became involved in this interesting lifestyle. Professional sociologists don't usually come straight out and admit on the first page of their books. I interviewed respondents naked occasionally, but professional sociologists have mostly nervously eschewed researching explicitly erotic environments. Consequently, there aren't solid methodological precedents for proper research conduct and procedure in the kinds of contexts where interviews might get interrupted by a violent fake quote-unquote kidnapping stampeding through it. This actually happened during one of my interviews. There was, quite simply, nothing that was remotely, quote-unquote, normal about my research experiences, and I might as well warn you on page one that there's not really much that's normal about me as a person either. In a subculture full of oddballs, I eventually rose through the ranks to become a respected and even odder oddball, or as my friend Alex put it, not just a standard deviant. I'm not going to pretend to an objectivity I don't possess. I'm going to tell you the story of my people and the kooky social world they built for themselves to celebrate their deviance. This book is a collective autobiography of the BDSM subculture from 2010 to 2017, as told by its self-appointed chief recorder and analyst, me. Another reason I've bluntly confessed from the start that I conducted some of my interviews naked is that I want to make it abundantly clear that I consider myself an enthusiastic participant in Jason Oren's project of carnal sociology. Beginning with Alfred Kinsey, 1948, scholars of sex and sexuality have generally sought to distance themselves from the more salacious aspects of their research in what often looks like a desperate bid for legitimacy and respect. From Michel Foucault, 1990, to Judith Butler, 1990, and continuing to most recent scholarship, this tendency to disregard the carnal and corporeal pleasures of fucking in favor of the theoretical pleasures of sesquipedalian verbosity has typically left me with the impression that scholars have taken one of the most interesting subjects in the world, sex, and made it as tedious as tallying gall wasps. A conspicuous exception to this trend, Orn, 2017, makes a sort of call to arms for other sexual sociologists to join him in doing carnal sociology and putting fucking and carnal sense back into the study of sex. There is a corporeal world of physical, emotional, and social pleasure in the BDSM subculture, and it is sweaty, orgasmic, emotional, tearful, agonizing, joyful, compassionate, and many other things besides. My top priority in writing this book is to convey to you at least some hint of that intense and pleasurable reality. Researching under abnormal conditions. In the summer of 2012, one might easily have mistakenly imagined that the BDSM subculture wasn't quite so peculiar because BDSM appeared to be going mainstream thanks to the unfathomable success of 50 Shades of Grey, James 2011. These three novels, which eventually became three movies about a supposedly not kinky woman's, Anastasia, relationship with a very kinky man, Christian, were jaw-droppingly successful. Though BDSM as a fantasy might have been headed mainstream, the scene, which is what pansexual kinksters call the BDSM subculture, definitely wasn't. The scene consists of a vast array of purely social events, munches and happy hours, evening parties where BDSM activities play are allowed, educational events where people learn about various aspects of BDSM, and days-long BDSM events that take place in hotels and campgrounds. Additionally, a great deal of BDSM socializing happens online. The pansexual BDSM is so called to differentiate it from the separate but slightly overlapping gay/lesbian BDSM subculture, often called the leather subculture, and also from the slightly more overlapped dyke plus trans BDSM subculture described by Bauer 2014. The pansexual scene, hereafter just referred to as the scene or the BDSM subculture, primarily consists of straight/heteroflexible cis men and bi/pansexual cis women who tend to be in heteroromantic, meaning opposite sex, long-term relationships. Members of the scene refer to themselves as kinksters. In the social world of the pansexual scene, the specter of the other for kinksters is definitely not our kinky, gay, lesbian, queer brethren. It's the normal people, vanillas, who we imagine live monogamous lives with their two children in cookie-cutter suburban houses surrounded by white picket fences. During the summer of my fieldwork, many kinksters worried that 50 Shades would inspire hordes of these outsiders to come in and ruin everything that was cool about the scene. Many kinksters I spoke with that summer invoked the threat of a soccer mom invasion, a phrase often repeated verbatim, to signify the doom of the scene at the gormless hands of sexually unsatisfied, not really, quote-unquote, kinky housewives. Yet the predicted invasion never occurred because the scene, which is by no means culturally unified, has always been and remains a relatively secluded home, kinksters' own term, for social misfits. In truth, the scene is fueled by participants' deep desire not to be normal, and their awareness of themselves as weird, much more than by their desire to consensually hit each other with whips and floggers. It's a place where largely white, well-educated geeks come to play, meaning, with the consent of all parties, that they do things from flogging to rope bondage to sticking needles in each other, all the way up to the aforementioned brutal kidnapping, and occasionally have public sex while they do. Consent is fundamental to the way kinksters approach what they do. Excuse me. Consent is fundamental to the way kinksters approach what they do, with many hours of education and community discussion devoted to the idea that people need to make well-informed decisions to ensure that what they do is BDSM and not abuse. The system is far from perfect, but the subculture at least makes an earnest attempt. In the case of Camp O-Town, 800 to 1200 people converge several times a year on a private campground to do these things together for several days at a time, in a utopian space where vanillas rarely tread and where vanilla rules don't apply. The scene as a whole, and Camp O-Town especially, are intentionally designed to make normal people feel unwelcome, regardless of how alluring they find the idea of orgasming from being hit in the clitoris with a riding crop. In a social world that views normalcy in Durkheimian terms as profane, which is to say the antithesis of what is cherished or valued in the culture, following conventional expectations for research professionalism would certainly have worked against me. I was fully embedded personally in the local BDSM scene by early 2010, identifying myself, as so many in the scene do, as polyamorous, kinky, pansexual, and pagan, all words I'll explain. When I began planning my research project in 2011, all the published sociological research on the pansexual BDSM subculture had been conducted by people who either were very conspicuously not kinky, Newmar 2011, Wise 2011, or were completely obscuring their involvement in the community, whom I won't cite for obvious reasons. Reading these accounts, I was frustrated by what I perceived as a lack of social science empathy for and understanding of this group that society at large already misunderstands. In short, the literature begged for an insider's perspective to balance so many writings from outsiders, and I nominated myself for the job. Conspicuously absent from that earlier sociological writing is acknowledgement of and compassion for the dark undercurrent of shame that runs through the BDSM subculture and the experiences of kinky people. As a self-identified kinkster, I understood what it meant to crave pain at a basic physiological level for my entire life. And in the classic terms of Goffman's conceptualization of stigma, I also understood how much that craving tainted their/my credibility within mainstream society. I recognize that my telling you that I spend much of my free time going to camps where people consensually tie and beat each other up for pleasure, with an outdoor gangbang here and there for added excitement, might have already made you suspect that I may be in need of psychological help and that my research might be inherently compromised. My university's ethics board was initially disgusted by my proposed research, with the head of the board arguing that it was unethical to stand by while people were being hurt and doing nothing to stop it. She became speechless when I challenged, "Even when that person is having an orgasm?" My status as a community insider ultimately worked to my advantage, since the board was obviously uncomfortably aware that when they said that what kinksters did was bad, they were also saying that what I did was bad. I shamed the university into not only approving it, but also giving me funding. Those kinds of suspicions and disgust are stigma in action, and I understood all too well what social stigma against kinksters felt like in a way that outsiders to kink really didn't seem to. Closely connected to that undercurrent of shame is a sea of medicalization. Medicalization refers to the way that doctors and other medical professionals pathologize conditions that might otherwise be perceived as normal or healthy, which tends to result in stigma against the people being medicalized. For years, psychologists pathologized BDSM. Thanks to extensive activism from kinksters, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, DSM, which psychologists use to diagnose mental illness, modified the pathology of sexual sadism in the early 2000s to exclude people who derive sexual pleasure from consensually hurting other people. The stigma of medicalization was so strong that it seemed to even affect the vocabulary choices of sociologists and anthropologists, who until recently usually wrote about SM and sadomasochism years after people within the community had begun referring to S&M, BDSM, and kink. See, for example, Harvainen, 2011. Kinky people call themselves kinky, but social scientists seemed afraid to use this label themselves, as if they were ashamed of the very people they were studying. This hesitation parallels the way that social scientists kept writing about homosexuals, who psychologists also thought had a mental illness until 1973, long after the so-called homosexuals had started calling themselves gays and lesbians. As a result, kinksters are understandably leery of social scientists, and my position as an insider gave me serious advantages in terms of access in this normally very research or unfriendly context. I didn't have to pretend to be an insider. At most of the events I attended the summer of my fieldwork, I interviewed people all day and then played all night. But I consciously invoked my insider status when engaging with actual and potential participants to gain their trust. I started dyeing my hair bright manic panic colors, as many kinksters do, and showing up for interviews wearing whatever was appropriate for the context, from street clothes to nothing. As a result, even when I was doing interviews outside of kink events and settings like coffee houses, I still looked more like one of our people, a joking phrase kinksters sometimes use when identifying one another in the outside world. All told, I collected 70 interviews with a wide range of kinky folks, including people who had never been to events, people who were at their first ever event, and people who had been in the scene for 20 or more years. Throughout, I went out of my way to make sure my respondents perceived me as being like them, which wasn't hard because I generally was. There are so few guidelines for how to conduct research in these types of deviant contexts because historically, even when sociologists have done qualitative research with deviant communities like the scene, both the larger culture and academic circles have expected the sociologist either to be visiting outsiders or to politely hand wave at their level of personal involvement. For example, Becker's seminal study of the marijuana subculture in the 1950s glossed over his personal involvement in it. In contrast, other sociologists who were trying to obscure their own levels of involvement in deviant subcultures, I made a personal, political, and academic commitment when I began studying the BDSM subculture to be the first out American sociologist to do so. For a discussion of what it means to be out, see Orn 2011. At no point in my research process have I ever hidden the fact that I was personally involved in the BDSM community for several years before I began studying it, and I've remained heavily involved in it since the completion of my official fieldwork in the fall of 2012. You might worry that my position as an insider means I'll be less critical of the scene. It's true that I'm less critical of some things than most of the outsiders I have read. However, I'm also very critical of different things because rather than imposing the judgment of an external observer, I apply the classical standard of a good ethnographer. I judge the scene's ability to achieve its goals based on its own values. In general, I have found that as long as I hold on to my sociological imagination, that is, an analytical awareness of the larger social context of individual experiences, my position as an insider actually provides me with better opportunities to frankly critique the social construction of meaning and values in the BDSM scene. As you read this book, imagine how condescending some of the critiques of the scene I offer would sound coming from an outsider versus how they sound coming from an insider. There is, after all, a world of difference between saying, we made a mistake versus they made a mistake. That difference is my biggest asset as an insider. That said, I think I have had one serious disadvantage as an insider, which is simply that I am white. As I will explain, the scene is extremely white, and I was obviously unable to attend social events that were specifically for people of color, even though I dated, played with, and befriended Black people in the scene and went out of my way to disproportionately interview them. I rarely found people who were eager to talk about race with me much. Asians are also rare in the mid-Atlantic scene, and non-white Hispanics even more so. I would like to think this hesitancy on the part of others wasn't a personal problem with me, as I certainly found a few Black friends who were delighted to talk about race with me, but the general attitude among everyone in the scene mostly seems to be, don't talk about race if we can avoid it. In particular, as a white kinkster, I learned quickly by watching others that anything I said in a public forum about race would almost certainly offend and anger many people, especially many people of color, and I was better off keeping my mouth shut. I have not been able to escape that training in writing this book, and I hope readers will understand my hesitancy in talking about race to be an awkward product of my social position as a white woman in the scene rather than a product of simply not noticing or not caring. Hobby or profession, 2013 to 2017. After I concluded my official fieldwork, my involvement in the scene changed greatly. People asked me what the difference was between doing fieldwork and just going to parties, and I joked that I wasn't taking notes when I was just going to parties. In reality, this was only half true. I could never stop taking notes with my eyes, and it's not like I could just turn my sociological imagination off. You know how in the TV show Sherlock, they show him going into rooms and compulsively noticing details about the way things are placed and mentally cataloging them? That's what a trained sociologist like me does in a social environment, but instead it's mental notes about the gender dynamics of how people interact, their race, their dress, their language use, and their collective social values. By 2014, I was traveling all over the United States and Canada to teach kinksters how to do kink. The BDSM subculture focuses heavily on education, and my day job as a sociology professor who researched the scene lent me serious cachet as a BDSM educator. Teaching so many classes in so many places had the important side benefit of allowing me to observe kinksters in most major American cities in their natural habitat. Although my original research site focused exclusively on the mid-Atlantic scene, in subsequent years I traveled from Texas to Toronto and even taught BDSM in Iceland. My observations in these different places confirm something I already knew from my original research. BDSM subcultural norms have much in common throughout the United States and Canada, but the scene is fundamentally a loosely networked set of microcultures. That means there are conspicuous differences in scenes based on cities, and even often based on the people who usually attend a specific party, event space, or meetup. By early 2017, I felt like my observations weren't quite enough to achieve my research goals, and they didn't seem to be sufficient for reviewers either, who were concerned that my insider position was biased rather than extremely well-informed. I wanted to confirm my loose and brief observations about the differences in scenes between cities and states, and I needed a lot of data to do that. Moreover, interviewers really are inadequate to tell you everything about a group when their behaviors and attitudes don't match, or when people aren't always consciously aware of their attitudes. So I fielded a survey in April 2017 to allow me to measure the scope of many attitudes, beliefs, and behaviors in the scene in ways that had never been published before. The timing for my survey was unintentionally perfect. By June of 2017, the Me Too movement, which had not yet acquired a name or hashtag and which wouldn't appear in the broader culture for another 2 months, began stampeding through the scene with the force of a rampaging elephant. High status within the scene, men were publicly banned for alleged consent violations against women. Given that men run most of the events in the scene, at least as figureheads, many events ceased to exist when their organizers were banned. As you'll see throughout this book, the scene depends on a complex system of trust, negotiation, and reputation to function. But in the wake of these bleak revelations, all these systems became increasingly anomic, meaning that the conventional rules and norms had broken down. Kinksters, reasonably, lost faith in the social institutions that had supported the scene, and alternative institutions didn't really emerge. People were angry, sad, anxious, afraid, and, worst of all, staying home. I hope that anyone researching the scene after me can use this book as a guide to figuring out why this crisis occurred and developing hypotheses about how the subculture might change or fail to in the wake of such a large-scale social panic. Because of the cataclysmic changes that bookend the period from 2010 to 2017, this book is, for all intents and purposes, a sociological present-day history of the pansexual BDSM scene during that time, with a focus on North America and the Mid-Atlantic in particular. In addition to the social changes in 2017, the scene had also changed radically in 2009, just before I arrived, when the social networking behemoth website FetLife appeared. FetLife is like Facebook for kinky people, only for that period it was even more important and ubiquitous. Before FetLife, people had to go out of their way to learn about the existence of the scene, its ways, and the parties and events that were happening. After FetLife, the entire scene was basically organized through FetLife, and literally everyone in the public scene was on it. New people joined every day and immediately had access to the kinds of scene information and gossip that used to take months or even years of in-person interaction to acquire. FetLife exploded rapidly. By February of 2010, when I attended my first kink event, it was already normative to put your FetLife nickname on your event name badge. By early 2013, I had numerous conversations with people about their FetLife user ID number, which was attached to profiles and ordered by when a person had joined. Anything under a million was considered a status symbol that one had been around a long time, and I knew one eccentric fellow who actually talked of having his FetLife number tattooed on him. It was no coincidence that I got into the scene along with so many other people in the post-FetLife internet explosion. It was pure luck that I fielded my survey only a month before the scene radically changed again in the midst of its own Me Too movement. So I am fortunate to be able to tell a fairly complete story of the scene during the FetLife era, especially since the other three books, Bauer 2014, Neumar 2011, Weiss 2011, about the scene discuss it pre-FetLife. Although I won't discuss much on FetLife itself here, in large part because the website is extremely nervous about researchers, remember as you read that the changes it brought to the scene are always part of the background social context of the scene, even when kinksters themselves have forgotten about it. Your fantasy is my reality. There's a popular shirt in the scene that quips, "Your fantasy is my reality." That one shirt summarizes the values of much of the scene, which tends to smugly present itself as a group who have had the courage to do what everybody wants to do but is too scared to. I regularly had debates with kinky friends who insisted that life in the scene was what everyone wanted but mostly lacked the will or social resources to achieve. I remain very skeptical of this perspective, but statistics support the idea that most Americans at least fantasize about the life the scene encourages. Leigh Miller's 2018 book was the first to broadly study American sexual fantasies, and he found that we overwhelmingly fantasize about consensual non-monogamy and BDSM, which are by far the top two most popular fantasies for both men and women. However, there's a pretty big gap between fantasizing and doing, and an even bigger gap between doing privately and doing something usually defined as private in front of a bunch of people you don't know well. This book explores that gap between the fantasy of BDSM and the reality of doing it publicly in a highly complex subculture, seeking to answer two main questions. If BDSM is such a popular fantasy, why do so few people become involved in the scene? And once they do, how does the scene shape their perspective on BDSM and relationships? I'll answer these questions chapter by chapter, but the short answer is that the BDSM subculture is a true subculture with a specific set of core values and norms that are only tangentially related to BDSM itself. And the vast majority of people who fantasize about BDSM probably don't fit in well with those other values and norms. The scene teaches people to understand, interpret, and practice BDSM in ways that probably don't appeal to the majority of people who occasionally fantasize about kink, and it attracts and maintains people who want to build an entire kinky life for themselves. If we think of the BDSM subculture as a place whose manifest function, which is to say its official social purpose, is to create a social space where common sexual fantasies can become manifest in improbable ways, we have to remember that while BDSM fantasies are extremely common, they are not the number one spot on Lay Miller's list. Consensual non-monogamy is. Consensual non-monogamy, CNM, which is more often called ethical non-monogamy by people who aren't academics, refers to relationships in which people openly agree to some type of non-monogamous arrangement, from a single night threesome to a long-term arrangement as polyamorous, meaning multiple romantic relationships with the consent of all involved parties. I'll explain a lot more about CNM in Chapter 3, but for now, suffice it to say that the scene's focus on maximum fantasy fulfillment means that a heavy focus on CNM is inevitable, since it's an even more common fantasy than BDSM. When people from the scene say, "Your fantasy is my reality," they're not just referring to the partner they have who can orgasm from being bitten. These people aren't mythical, I assure you. I've bitten some of them myself. They're referring to the fact that they have a wife and a girlfriend who can. This was very much my reality during the summer of 2012 when I was living the hedonistic dreams of the scene to the hilt. I had and have a husband who had and has a girlfriend, and I was dating a collection of people of various genders who will make brief appearances throughout the rest of this book. Many of my exploits were a bit ludicrous even by the generous standards of the scene. In between driving all over the mid-Atlantic to conduct face-to-face interviews and attend various days-long BDSM events, I undertook a deeply personal journey that echoed much of what you'll see from the people I interviewed. BDSM, and even more importantly, the scene, went from being a background interest to a central aspect of my social, romantic, and sexual life. No matter how critical I became of the scene later as its problems became increasingly large, and as I watched in heartbreak as two of my partners from that summer were eventually banned from it, I remain keenly aware of and grateful for the opportunities it created for me to have intense experiences most people don't even know to fantasize about. Yet no matter how much my life started to feel like I was walking through tangible porn, albeit porn with a lot less makeup, way better dialogue, and much smaller dicks, I was still constantly surrounded by real life, with real life problems of gossip, breakups, jealousy, and insecurity. Throughout this book, I'm going to try to foreground this contrast between fantasy and reality, because I think understanding it is fundamental to fully understanding life in the scene. What exactly is the scene? The term the scene is mostly used for convenience. There are pockets of related groups of people who do BDSM, and kinksters label the collection of them that mostly falls under the pansexual umbrella, the scene and the lifestyle. While they have much more in common than not, norms still vary among geographical areas and even among specific groups within the same area. A single charismatic individual often holds extraordinary sway over their own little fiefdom within this conglomerate. Kinksters themselves often make much of the differences and variations between groups, and as an insider, I tend to think that some of these differences are quite important as well. But I don't think many outsiders would notice a lot of these differences, which I'll discuss more in chapters 5 through 7. The majority of kinksters never go far beyond their own little scene microcosms, and are often unaware of the variations between them. There are many formal and informal BDSM organizations throughout the country. The more formal ones have cards and small membership dues. The most formally organized of these have volunteer boards of directors, but most of them are just groups of people who got together and decided to try to run something for the community. The things they run tend to take the form of social gatherings, classes, public parties, immersive days-long events that combine all those things, and sometimes private parties. Social gatherings, often called munches, generally consist of meeting at places like a restaurant or bar and taking over a large room or table, or sometimes the entire venue. Although some of these gatherings allow BDSM play, there's usually an expectation that the play will be pretty light, and sex is almost never allowed. The focus of these gatherings is meeting, networking, and socializing, although many also include some kind of education. Classes and workshops are usually between 1 and 2 hours, focusing on some aspect of BDSM, and may be in the form of lectures, discussion sessions, demonstrations, or hands-on learning experiences. It's normal to see classes on everything from blowjobs to single-tail whips to bondage to relationship strategies, mostly for polyamorous people. Typically, group organizers reach out to others they think might like to teach, but sometimes the potential teachers reach out to the organizers. Public parties usually happen at a local standing dungeon, BDSM club, or sometimes at a temporary location in a warehouse. Public parties are usually available to anyone who wants to go who hasn't been banned from the organization for some reason. Most kinksters learn about these parties from friends who are going or through FetLife. Most dungeons only occasionally throw parties of their own. Usually, they work out some sort of arrangement with other local groups, allowing those groups to throw parties at the dungeon. Private parties, confusingly, also often happen in local dungeons, but usually are much more selective in terms of who is allowed to attend. Groups may restrict attendance to people who are formal members of their groups, or to people who've attended a specific series of classes. Private parties are sometimes advertised on FetLife. Many happen in the homes of kinksters who have personal dungeons, and those are often exclusively invite-only from the host rather than being run by an organization or group. As there are entire large cities that have historically been unable to sustain a standing public dungeon for a variety of reasons, Boston was especially notorious for this at the time of my research, private parties have become the norm in those areas. Unsurprisingly, these scenes have a reputation for being cliquish and disconnected. For several years, there was a running joke in other scenes about waiting for the annual collapse of the Boston scene in a massive infighting. Think Mean Girls with collars. Days-long events take place either in hotels or on secluded campgrounds. They pretty much always include a wide array of educational programming and networking events, with parties every night. Hotel events tend to be much more restrained because of space and legal limitations. The police can raid hotel events at any time, although they rarely do, and people usually have to put on clothes and get on crowded public elevators to get from their dungeon play and hotel ballrooms to their rooms to shower. As many more extreme BDSM activities are pretty messy, from violent anal sex to peeing on people, things tend to be a bit tamer at hotel events. Also, most hotel events don't have much or any public play space during the day, and most of the play spaces at night are heavily supervised by hotel security. Camp events, on the other hand, tend to be much more private, with basically no vanilla supervision, and are much further away from the eye of the law. There are usually very few limitations on types or times of play at these events. Hotel events have an air of propriety about them that is entirely absent from the kinky, free-for-all spirit of most camp events. Many social gatherings are basically free or charge a nominal fee, $5 or so to get in, although there's often an expectation that people will buy food or drink once they're there. Most public dungeon parties cost anywhere from about $20 to $45 per person to attend for a night, so the cost of regular attendance can add up quickly. Most private parties held in public dungeons cost about the same, but house parties are often free, donation/potluck affairs, or very cheap. Days-long events average about $400 a person for admission and lodging, not including food, with hotel events generally costing more than camp events. If you're committed to getting to lots of days-long events, you almost always have to travel pretty long distances as well, because even in the Baltimore area, which has by far the most in the country, there are usually only 5 or 6 major events in any year. The people who are the most involved, however, usually aren't paying for all or even most of the events they go to. Most of the major BDSM organizations are run entirely by volunteers who are compensated, comped, but gaining admission for free into the parties and events where they work. Weekend dungeon parties require volunteers to work as event monitors, greeters, and snack bar salespeople, so many folks do those jobs in exchange for free admission to the party. The labor force required for days-long kink events is much larger, and there are many opportunities for comps to these events by doing everything from cleaning bathrooms to building slash taking down dungeon furniture to teaching to performing to working the registration desk. Many of these events have scaled comps so that people who do a lot of work also get free rooms or cabin spaces and sometimes free food as well. Unsurprisingly, people who are highly involved in organizations tend to burn out quickly, so turnover is high and continuous institutional knowledge is often weak. Working setup and takedown for many large events sometimes involves 1 to 2 days of additional labor on both ends of a 3 to 5 day event, so people who want to become involved that way need to have a lot of free time. Although there are a few very skilled professionals who happen to get a lot of time off and become highly involved in the scene, the vast majority of people at higher echelons of organization, volunteer staffing, and teaching are mostly underemployed. Essentially, a large body of much more loosely involved, usually richer, kinksters funds the involvement of a core group who often pay little or nothing. Although kinksters on the whole are a fairly well-educated lot, they really only average out to middle class, even though the most involved ones tend not to be very well off. Most upper class and upper middle class jobs don't allow for the kind of leisure time required to make a lifestyle out of BDSM. Regardless of level of involvement, once you put so much as a toenail into the BDSM subculture, usually meaning that you found yourself reading a blog or community website, it will start trying to throw rules and norms at you. I'll go over all of these in great depth in later chapters, but always keep in mind that the first and last principle that guides life in the scene is that the term consensual kink is basically redundant. If it's not consensual, it's abuse. Everything about life in the scene is structured and organized around trying to make behaviors that society says are always unethical and or downright illegal, e.g. slapping your partner across the face or having sex with someone while they say they don't want to, ethical and legalish under specific circumstances. It turns out that the lines between consensual and non-consensual are sometimes really, really fuzzy, but the scene tries incredibly hard to keep things as consensual looking as it reasonably can, both at the micro and macro levels. Deviant privilege. The general social response toward the extreme differentness of the scene is not neutral. During the course of my fieldwork, a prominent local party promoter was instantly demoted in the military when a coworker outed him as kinky. And one of my interviewees, a high-ranking official in a major government agency, had her job threatened when her superiors decided that she was essentially engaging in conduct unbecoming by presenting at kink events. The legality of BDSM is constantly in question, and its deviant status is sometimes at stake in child custody issues. Sociologists usually define deviance as behavior that violates social expectations and is viewed negatively, and that seems to be a fair characterization of life in the scene. The path to a deviant lifestyle, sometimes called career deviance, differs widely depending on the type of deviance, and we'll look more at the paths people take to the scene in the next chapter. Most theories of deviance, which are closely related to theories of crime, assume that people become deviant either because they don't have much to lose or because economic or social necessity drives them to it. In contrast to many other deviant subcultures, which are often motivated by depression, disillusion, or perceived or real deprivation, such as gangs, many drug subcultures, or neo-Nazi groups, the BDSM subculture seems like a pretty cheerful voluntary association. Williams, 2009, has argued that the BDSM subculture should be understood as a deviant leisure activity, meaning that people do this for fun and social enjoyment, in spite or because of its deviance. Newmar, 2010, goes further, arguing that the BDSM subculture is fundamentally about serious leisure, maintaining that it is an intense social hobby and not really focused on sex or sexuality at all. Meanwhile, Wise, 2011, and Chef and Hammers, 2011, focus on materialism and privilege in the BDSM subculture, noting that the scene is extremely disproportionately white and upper middle class. As I will discuss further in Chapter 5, while it might be tempting to think that the scene's whiteness is a product of unusually high levels of individual or structural racism within it, e.g., several reviewers of my own work have suggested that the legacy of slavery in both BDSM language and aesthetics of dominant submission and master-slave relationships accounts for the low presence of people of color in the scene, I do not think these arguments really explain the low numbers of people of color in the scene. All of the scene's adjacent subcultures, none of which carry any legacy of slavery, are also extremely white. Although the scene is hardly a race utopia, it has an extremely low tolerance for racist ideology, and interracial dating is very normalized there. Note that it's not really encouraged per se, because to encourage it would require calling much more attention to race than is the scene norm. Rather, I think the whiteness of the scene is more a product of participation in the BDSM subculture being, one, a leisure activity, and two, a deviant leisure activity. As a deviant leisure activity, unlike many other forms of deviance, privilege is actually an enabling factor for involvement in the scene. In exactly the same way that many of the first gays and lesbians to come out were people with high status, privilege means that people can potentially afford the economic and social cost of the stigma of kink. In essence, a major part of why the scene is so white is because society is structurally racist and because society stigmatizes BDSM. Moreover, the scene is a voluntary association, and the overall structural racism of society means that voluntary associations in America tend to be extremely racially segregated, especially churches. The scene is no exception. The demographic composition of the scene closely resembles that of its adjacent sub/countercultures. The gaming geek subculture, Guild Renaissance Festival subculture, the pagan subculture, and the polyamorous subculture, which is so heavily overlapped as to be difficult to distinguish from. All of these subcultures are largely populated by very liberal, disproportionately well-educated, hetero-coupled/interested, pagan or religiously unaffiliated people under 50. Almost by sociological default, these characteristics mean that their members are largely white and upper middle class, but most people who are not still fit the rest of that profile. The scene selects for my initially listed characteristics first, and those characteristics uncoincidentally happen to associate with white upper middle class people, thus inevitably reinforcing the race class homogeneity of the scene. The crossover between the above listed subcultures is extremely high, with many of my interviewees recounting stories of entering the BDSM scene through one of these other groups. All of which is to say that kinky may very well be a sexual orientation that is more or less randomly distributed within the population, at least when it comes to a preference for persistent and/or relatively intense kink. Yet because the BDSM subculture is first and foremost a social group, there's no reason to imagine that all kinky people are involved in it any more than it's reasonable to expect that all gay men are involved in the gay men's club culture described by Orn, 2017. And indeed, statistics strongly suggest that most gay men are not. Participation in the BDSM scene is not required to be kinky any more than participation in gay men's club culture is required to be gay. As best I can define it, broadly speaking, kinky people enjoy a vaguely defined set of practices known as BDSM with mutually consenting partners, whereas people who prefer ambivalent consent for similar practices might be described as abusive, and people who clearly want victims who have not consented for similar practices might be described as torturers. Throughout the rest of this book, I'll mostly talk about kinksters and people in the BDSM subculture, and please do not misunderstand that to mean all kinky people or all people who desire BDSM. There are many BDSM communities, including the aforementioned gay and lesbian leather communities and dyke plus trans BDSM community, as well as a community of spankers, and even a small community of people who engage in Christian domestic discipline. All of these communities overlap at least a little with the pansexual BDSM subculture that I am shorthanding to the scene and the BDSM subculture. Even aside from all these people who are part of BDSM-related social communities, there are almost certainly many, many more people who engage in BDSM privately. And those privately kinky people's values, norms, and practices probably have relatively little to do with the people and social world I'm describing. In short, BDSM practitioner does not mean that someone is in the scene, but basically everyone in the scene is a BDSM practitioner. I have a little bit of information about privately kinky people, but all of the people I have information about were publicly kinky enough to be willing to take a survey targeted at people who considered themselves part of the BDSM subculture, or volunteer to do an in-depth interview with a researcher investigating BDSM, so I'm more inclined to say they're in a gray area between public and private kink. Even scene involvement itself can be a very ambivalent concept, as many people join, leave, sometimes for years at a time, and then come back. There are, at any given time, far more people who are hazily involved in the scene than people who are clearly involved in it. Throughout this book, I will explicate the values, norms, and practices of this core group of highly and consistently involved members and describe their effects on kinksters who are more peripheral in the scene. How to read this book? No sociologist have published a book about the post-FetLife, post-Fifty Shades scene. For that matter, non-academic books explaining the social world of the scene are pretty scarce too. So I'm optimistically assuming that the audience for this book is going to be somewhat eclectic, and I'm likewise assuming that what you take away from this book is going to inevitably reflect why you came to it. For sociologists, since the earliest days of sociology with Durkheim's 1897 Classical Study of Suicide, one of the founding principles of sociology is that society and culture can profoundly affect even the most intimate and seemingly individualistic aspects of people's lives. In this study, I show how the BDSM subculture differs significantly from mainstream culture in its understanding, interpretation, and experience of the physical, emotional, and relational aspects of BDSM. This subcultural influence is so strong that it can reshape people's basic physical experiences of pain and pleasure. I also explicate the many rules and norms the scene employs to try to regulate members' behavior and resist drifting into actual criminality, in spite and because of its status as a highly stigmatized deviant community. For sexuality scholars, as discussed earlier, this book enthusiastically participates in Orne's 2017 project of carnal sociology by explicitly discussing sex, sexuality, and pleasure as corporeal experiences. It does not delve deeply into theoretical development. Following the principles laid out by sociologist Robert Merton in 1967, who argued that data must be the foundation of all good theoretical development, an argument more recently picked up by Besbris and Kahn 2017, I argue that our data on BDSM are too rudimentary to support intense theoretical exploration. Instead of pretending to a level of data sophistication that simply does not exist in this area of study, this book provides rich empirical information from multiple data sources to inform future theoretical development once we have a better understanding of this super complicated and nebulous thing that is BDSM. This book will publish the first large-scale survey findings about the American BDSM subculture with more than 1,600 respondents and contains the largest interview sample, 70 interviewees, as well as the most geographically diverse ethnographic observations to date. For mental health professionals and social workers, it is very difficult at present to find a picture of what BDSM relationships look like outside of a highly dysfunctional clinical context, or the often somewhat rosy and idealistic portrait many BDSM advocates provide. This book will give you a more realistic sense of how kinksters imagine themselves, what they aspire to in their identities and relationships, and some of the common places where a mismatch appears between ideals and realities. You should have a good sense from reading this book of what the average kinkster is like and what an average kinky relationship is like. For undergraduate and graduate sociology students, this book aims to provide a rich methodological experience as you contemplate some of the weird challenges of doing insider interviews and ethnography as a member of a sexually explicit subculture. Along the way, I'll provide an overview and introduction to some of the core principles in the sociological studies of deviant sexuality and gender. For privately kinky and kink-curious folks, yes, we have a label for you in the scene, taken from the term bi-curious for heretofore hetero or homosexual people interested in exploring sexual experiences with the other side. Maybe you're sitting on the fence, wondering if you really are kinky and if you should take the plunge and show up for a kink event near you. Maybe you were a fan of 50 Shades of Grey and want to know what real BDSM lives look like. You'll find a lot about real-world kink identities, relationships, and experiences in the scene in this book that should help you make up your mind. But be warned, I haven't sugarcoated things here to make them easier to digest for you the way many introductory BDSM educators will. This is the nitty-gritty of the scene, not its rosy face for newcomers. For interested vanillas, as I'll explain in the next chapter, the line between kinky and vanilla is a thin one that the scene maintains largely for its own convenience. I expect that some of you will be reading this because your kinky family member or friend wanted you to better understand their lives. I have striven in this book to fairly and accurately represent us, and what I most hope you will learn from this book is the truth about the extravagant pleasures and staggering mundanity that is life in the scene. I hope that you will read with an open mind. For my fellow kinksters, the greatest moments of sociological insight are the ones that take us outside ourselves, making the familiar strange. I hope that this book opens your eyes to aspects of the scene that you never noticed or never had words to explain before. And I want us to be honest about our problems, even as we celebrate the things that make our lives so much fucking fun. And for you, a different word of caution. Nothing in this book is intended to be representative of everyone in the scene, so if your experience differs wildly from something or many things you see here, please don't assume that I have made an error. Maybe you're just unusual or in a different place. For everyone reading, I'll show how this deviant subculture tries to regulate and influence intensely personal behaviors in an unusually public context. It not only regulates how kinksters do BDSM in a practical sense, but it also regulates the relationship context they do it in and the meaning they find from it, and teaches them how to perform BDSM. Additionally, I'll show how the subculture sometimes fails to regulate behavior in patterned ways. I don't know that the crisis of the scene in 2017 was really predictable, but it is traceable back to some key conflicting values and norms in the scene leading up to it. However, to make this book purely a story of failure would be a great disservice to all the kinksters who found and still find a home in the scene. Sociology by its nature tends to be grimly analytical because it's a problem-oriented discipline. It's hard to make a sophisticated-sounding argument about joy, so I'm not going to try. And I'll simply say at the outset that most of the kinksters I interviewed in 2012 were pretty darned happy with their lives in the scene. Thus, I've made a scholarly choice to emphasize happiness and pleasure in this book because that's what kinksters talked about. The arc of this book will take you from the micro individual toward the more macro community social level of life in the scene. I'll start with identities, then move to relationships, and then to group norms and rules. In chapter 1, I'll explain how kinksters learn to define kink, BDSM, and kinky, and to construct socially meaningful identities for themselves as kinksters. Chapter 2 tackles the complex question of what kinksters get out of doing BDSM, with a particular focus on how they experience BDSM as sexual or not. Chapter 3 examines the way the scene teaches kinksters to do relationships in a specifically consensually non-monogamous polyamorous way. Chapter 4 looks at the way kinksters do BDSM relationships. Chapter 5 explains scene demographics as well as behavioral and attitudinal norms. Chapter 6 describes the real-life world of dungeons and the scene's style of performative BDSM. Chapter 7 looks at how the scene constructs positive and negative social status for members. And the conclusion reflects on the scene's world of BDSM versus the somewhat speculative world of BDSM outside of it. So with that plan in mind, let's start with an important social question of definitions. Namely, who gets to decide what it means to be kinky in the first place? Thank you.